where that comes from? Is it religion? And then the other second point is about Camus and the intellectual and how they fail to deal with this, because also here, as we speak, and there's so much going on in the indigenous community, crimes of rape, mass scale, stealing children today, and you rarely hear anything about it anywhere. How that was the case before the war in Algiers, 1954, how were these so-called intellectual Camus companies dealing with this whole thing?
Well, the first question, I don't think it's only the U.S. I think, yes, in the 19th century, especially towards the end and beginning of the 20th, you had the eugenicist movement. But a lot of the research was also done in France. Dr. Broca, and talking about the lady who was, you know, raising the issue of the doctors, Dr. Broca had engaged in what Stephen Jay Gould, the late Stephen Jay Gould, called scientific racism. This is a wonderful book Stephen Jay Gould wrote called, you know, The Mismeasure of Men. Dr. Broca in France wanted to establish scientifically a hierarchy of races. And so he collected all these skulls, black skulls, you know, white skulls, all the races of humanity. And, you know, he would stuff them with mustard seeds. And as you know, if you push a lot, you know, if you compress the seeds, you know, a lot of seeds can be contained in the cavity of what used to be the brain. And so, to his amazement, one of the skulls took a lot of mustard seeds, and it happened to be that of a black woman from Africa. So that created a problem for him. And because he was equating volume of skull with intelligence, and before he died, he donated his skull to science, and lo and behold, his skull was actually quite small. So, you know, it's an issue of power. If I learned anything in doing this research, and there were times when I lost all faith in humanity, but there were some other times when I would read about the general saying, I will not have torture, you know, in my unit. Or you have a Frenchman like Henri Alleg, you know, who was tortured mercilessly as if he had been an Algerian. Then if one thing I learned is that conscience, and I have a chapter on conscience. Conscience is the most elastic thing there is. So torturers play these games with their conscience. The priests were playing games. They knew that torture is immoral. They knew that if they believed in God, that this is not something that they would actually condone. So conscience is the most elastic part of our makeup as human beings. And of course, power is really the most important part of this. If you have the power, then if you're unopposed, you can carry out the most fanciful, fantastic ideas about how to deal with people. I mean, if you discount, you know, the work of this scientist, you know, Broca and company, but if you look at the intellectual proper, the people who write about the human condition, who are supposed to enlighten us about the human condition, I think here, by and large, the French come off looking much better than our contemporaries here in the United States. Because take Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist philosopher, he never departed from his opposition to torture. Not only was he opposed to torture, but he was also opposed to colonialism, and he saw colonialism as a debasing system. He distinguished between a national identity and imperial identity. He felt that he was a Frenchman and he was not going to be an imperial Frenchman. And this was a very, very important issue for the French military, how to instill an imperial identity in the conscripts, because the draft existed at the time. And the young people then, you know, they didn't want to fight. They knew that the country lost Vietnam. They were young. They wanted to have a good time. And they felt, why should they get blown away in Algeria? So many of them didn't want to go and fight. And so the French army had to enlist the services of a right-wing Catholic organization called Cité Catholique so they could create, this was illegal, secret cells within the military so they could actually sell the war to the young people. But by and large, the French intellectuals were against torture. We don't have that many in this country, very few. But here we have actually intellectuals who write about justifying torture, if not advocating it.
Professor Marnia Lasreg, author of Torture and the Twilight of Empire, From Algiers to Baghdad, speaking last month in New York City. The talk was recorded and produced by Fred Wien from WBAI Radio, courtesy of Fans Miles Productions. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Our next three speakers were part of a forum, Torture and the American Psyche, held in Brookline, Massachusetts on May 3rd. We'll begin with Stephen Soles, professor at the Boston Graduate School for Psychoanalysis, who has become an expert in and dedicated activist against the role of psychologists in interrogation and torture.
I think it makes sense to generalize a bit and say that societies contain two forces. One, the state with all its mighty powers, and the other, public opinion and civil society, organized and unorganized. A healthy public sphere is an essential prerequisite to restrain the powers of the state, any state, especially during times of crisis. The last 7 years have taught us American citizens, and indeed citizens around the world, that the state, no matter how nominally democratic, cannot be trusted to respect and protect those human rights that resulted from centuries of struggle. Under the pretext of fighting terrorism, restrictions on spying on our communications, on entering our homes without a warrant, on detaining individuals, non-citizens and citizens alike, without trial for years on end with no appeal, and on torturing those individuals, were thrown overboard with only occasional institutional pushback from within our government. And many of our society's other institutions closed their eyes to or even aided these abuses of long-established rights and freedoms, our press, for example. As has been the case so often in the past, it has fallen to citizens, as individuals and in small groups and organizations, to resist these encroachments on the basic nature of what it means to be free. Society depends on these individuals and organizations to constitute a force continually struggling against the ever-expansive powers of the state, those who, when faced with these abuses, cry stop. The story I have to tell today concerns torture, that body and soul destroying set of interrogation techniques that were banned by international agreement decades ago. Despite being banned, torturers remained alive, utilized by many of those countries that adopted the United Nations Convention Against Torture that banned the practice. Our country is one of those that maintained a relationship with torture. From the 1950s till the 1970s, the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, engaged in a decades-long research program to develop effective interrogation techniques as part of the SOCAB MKUltra program. One of the CIA's strengths was coming up with these bizarre non-acronyms for their things that make you sound like a conspiracy nut for even uttering them. The MKUltra program was revealed in congressional hearings in 1975. By the way, the CIA stated that 130 academic institutions were involved in their endeavors, but refused to release the names of these institutions. It is known that many of our most prominent psychologists, among others, were participants in MKUltra. This research resulted in a systematic approach to coercive interrogations involving psychological techniques such as prolonged isolation, sensory deprivation, sensory overload, overwhelming with very loud music, for example, self-induced pain, those so-called stress positions that we saw in those Abu Ghraib photographs and that we see in the couple of photographs that are coming out of Guantanamo, and sexual and cultural humiliation. The CIA interrogation was codified, again in one of their weird names, in the so-called Kubark Interrogation Manual, and it's Chapter 9 on Coercive Counterintelligence Interrogation of Resistance Sources. This chapter was based on what psychologists studying communist interrogations called the Debility Dependency Dread, or DDD, model for breaking down prisoners. Later, these techniques were secretly embodied in a series of torture manuals developed by the CIA for dissemination of pro-U.S. regimes in Latin America. After decades of denial that these manuals existed, the Baltimore Sun newspaper obtained one of them, the 1983 Honduran version of these manuals, entitled the Human Resource Exploitation Training Manual. The Baltimore Sun headline tells all. Torture was taught by CIA. Declassified manual details the methods used in Honduras. Agency denials refuted. There is a lesson here that when it comes to claims of illicit clandestine activities such as torture, official denials are worth exactly nothing. During the 1970s and 80s, hundreds of thousands fell victim to torturers across much of Latin America. Many of these torturers were trained by the United States, sometimes at the so-called School of the Americas, where it was eventually revealed that torture, as in the Human Resource Exploitation Manual, was standard fare in the curriculum. There is substantial evidence that various covert U.S. operatives were present during many of these tortures. And these operatives, in some cases, demonstrated torture techniques, including murdering those tortured to keep them silent. During the Vietnam War, along with the tens of thousands of civilians, presumed members of the National Liberation Front infrastructure, who were killed during the so-called Operation Phoenix, many thousands were tortured. Of course, much of this torture was conducted by the South Vietnamese government, our ally, but there is extensive documentation the U.S. Special Forces and other clandestine forces trained and often supervised many of the torturers. During the Clinton administration, I resisted a bad joke. During the Clinton administration, the U.S. engaged in a fight with al-Qaeda, started authorizing so-called rendition flights where suspected terrorists were kidnapped and delivered to countries that our own State Department reported engaged in torture, countries such as Egypt and Jordan, Morocco and Syria. I was recently at a conference with the ambassador from Egypt who, when asked about torture, not by me, I thought that was impolite, but by somebody else, sort of said, I would never legalize torture. There they were tortured, and the information was returned to the CIA. There were reports that people with American accents were sometimes present during these tortures. Thus did the United States, in the spirit of globalization, outsource its dirtiest of its dirty work. One consequence, however, was that the United States, when it returned torture to U.S. government agencies, had a dearth of recent firsthand experience available. They had had others doing the work. That's where the matter stood at the time of 9/11. The U.S., with its long history of torture, had a dearth of expertise. All who read the press know by now that torture, a.k.a. harsh interrogations, a.k.a. enhanced interrogation techniques, were authorized by the President of the United States based upon bogus legal doctrines created for the purpose by a bevy of lawyers from the Vice President's office, the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, and the President's Counsel, Alberto Gonzalez. But where did the expertise come from if the U.S. had largely outsourced its torture over the last decade? There was one place in the U.S. government with the desired expertise. This was the military's Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape Program, pronounced SEER, designed to teach pilots, special forces, and others how to resist breaking if captured and tortured by a country that does not obey the Geneva Conventions. That's the key phrase, does not obey the Geneva Conventions. SEER is quite clear that these are, that what they do is in violation of Geneva Conventions. It's to protect against that. As the Defense Department Office of the Inspector General said in a report quietly declassified last May, SEER training incorporates physical and psychological pressures, which act as counter-resistance techniques to replicate harsh conditions that the service member might encounter if they are held by forces that do not abide by the Geneva Conventions. During SEER training, service members are subjected to torture over several days, including sleep deprivation, beating, sexual humiliation, being combined in tiny spaces, and in some cases, waterboarding. It was to SEER that the U.S. government turned for its expertise. The SEER techniques were to resist breaking were reverse engineered to design counter-resistance techniques to break down detainees. Through a concept known as jointness, Special Forces personnel were lent to the CIA under orders from the White House. Now, an interesting feature of SEER was the prominent role of one profession, unfortunately, one of my professions, psychologists, in the program. Psychologists were present at SEER to supervise the abuse of our troops to evaluate how much stress an individual could tolerate. Of course, in that setting, it was in everyone's interest to not go too far, to not cause psychological or physical damage to the troops. It was in particular to these psychologists that the government turned. One of the first personnel assigned under jointness was Colonel Morgan Banks, described in his biography as the senior Army survival, evasion, resistance, and escape psychologist responsible for the training and oversight of all Army SEER psychologists. He provides technical support and consultation to all Army psychologists providing interrogation support. And his office currently provides the only Army training for psychologists in repatriation planning, that's bringing back if captured, and interrogation support and behavioral profiling. Colonel Banks was sent to Afghanistan and was present at Bagram Air Base, the major U.S. detention facility, where, as the New York Times stated in a May 23, 2005 editorial, the investigative file on Bagram, attained by the Times, showed that the mistreatment of prisoners was routine. Shackling them to the ceilings of their cells, depriving them of sleep, kicking and hitting them, sexually humiliating them, and threatening them with guard dogs. The very same behavior later repeated in Iraq. And the film Taxi to the Dark Side focuses upon this and the murder of a taxi driver in Bagram at the time. Now, we don't know exactly what Colonel Banks did at Bagram. Whatever he did, he certainly didn't stop the abuse going on there. As reported in Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, and Salon.com, when the CIA brought torture in-house at its secret black sites, it turned to former SEER psychologists James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who had a Spokane, Washington firm, Mitchell, Jessen & Associates, to design their interrogation program. Detainee Abu Zubaydah was initially questioned by the FBI using their standard rapport-building techniques. He revealed that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the architect of 9/11, and described the planning for the attack. However, the CIA wasn't satisfied with the FBI's rapport building, according to some accounts partly because it was the FBI who would get the credit, and sent a team, including psychologist James Mitchell, to get Zubaydah to reveal more by undertaking a systematic attack on his sense of self. As Vanity Fair reporter Catherine Eban described her findings in investigating this, I also discovered that psychologists weren't merely complicit in America's aggressive new interrogation regime. Psychologists, working in secrecy, had actually designed the tactics and trained interrogators in them while on contract to the CIA. Interrogators who were sent for classified training inevitably wound up in a Mitchell Jessen shop, and some balked at their methods. Instead of the careful training touted by President Bush, some recruits allegedly received on-the-job training during brutal interrogations that effectively unfolded as live demonstrations. Eban goes on to quote a knowledgeable source as stating, the basic approach was to break down the detainees through isolation, white noise, completely take away their ability to predict the future, create dependence on interrogators. That is, their approach was based upon the CIA's Kubark or debility, dependency, dread paradigm of psychological torture. Thanks to recent revelations, we know that part of their technique also included waterboarding, that paradigmatic torture involving partial drowning. We know that these tortures were videotaped and that the tapes were destroyed to prevent their becoming public. And we now know, thanks to ABC News 3 weeks ago, that this torture was micromanaged out of the White House with presidential approval by the so-called Principals Committee of Condoleezza Rice, Richard Cheney, Colin Powell, George Tenet, and Alberto Gonzalez, who, according to reports that have been confirmed, had the techniques demonstrated to them and would decide how much of each technique and in what combinations particular detainees could get. They had many, many of these meetings to micromanage it. Now there is much more to be said about the transformation of SEER techniques into a standard operating procedure for U.S. torture. The Office of the Inspector General of the Defense Department report, the one that was declassified last May, documents how SEER staff trained the so-called behavioral science consultation teams, usually referred to as BISCITs, at Guantanamo, who are primarily psychologists in these counter-resistance techniques. These BISCITs applied SEER-type techniques to Guantanamo detainees. One BISCIT psychologist, Major John Lesso, is known to have been present during the torture of Mr. Al-Qahtani, thanks to the leaked interrogation log obtained by Time magazine and available on the web. Mr. Al-Qahtani was believed to be the 20th hijacker in 9/11. The Al-Qahtani interrogation included, as bioethicist Stephen Miles summarizes, for 11 days beginning November 23rd, Al-Qahtani was interrogated for 20 hours each day by interrogators working in shifts. He was kept awake with music, yelling, loud white noise, or brief opportunities to stand. He then was subjected to 80 hours of nearly continuous interrogation until what was intended to be a 24-hour recuperation. This recuperation was entirely occupied by hospitalization for hypothermia. His body temperature had fallen to dangerous levels that resulted from deliberately abusive use of an air conditioner. After the hospitalization, he was hooded, shackled, put on a litter, and taken by ambulance to an interrogation room for 12 more days of interrogation, punctuated by a few brief naps. He was then allowed to sleep for 4 hours before being interrogated for 10 more days, except for naps of up to 1 hour. He was allowed 12 hours of sleep on January 1, but for the next 11 days, the exhausted and increasingly non-communicative prisoner was only allowed naps of 1 to 4 hours as he was interrogated. While psychologist Major Lesso registered no objection to Al-Qahtani's treatment, the FBI did. Here's what an FBI agent reported. In September or October of 2002, that's before the interrogation in the log, FBI agents observed that a canine was used in an aggressive manner to intimidate detainee after he had been subjected to intense isolation for over 3 months. During that time period, he was totally isolated, with the exception of an occasional interrogation, in a cell that was always flooded with light. By late November, so when the interrogation that described above was starting, the detainee was evidencing behavior consistent with extreme psychological trauma, talking to non-existent people, reporting hearing voices, crouching in the corner of a cell covered with a sheet for hours on end. Mr. Qahtani's interrogation or torture continued for at least 6 more weeks after the FBI reported he was in this state. Now imagine what kind of intelligence they could have gotten out of somebody who is crouching in a corner, talking to non-existent people, reporting hearing voices. You know, is it even conceivable they could have gotten any useful, actionable information out of him? One might think that professional organizations of psychologists might be distressed, even outraged, at their colleagues aiding the torture of a detainee, resulting in extreme psychological trauma. One might imagine that, faced with an ever-increasing stream of revelations about the role of psychologists in designing, conducting, and standardizing abusive interrogations, the American Psychological Association might take action to stop their members cooperating with the Bush administration's regime of torture. One might imagine that, but one would be wrong. To this date, the American Psychological Association, or its leadership, has uttered not one word of concern about the roles of psychologists in abusing detainees or in teaching others to abuse. I want to be clear, they have criticized abuse. They have not commented on the role of psychologists in that abuse.
Professor Stephen Soles.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Leonard Rubinstein, president of Physicians for Human Rights. For those who don't know, Physicians for Human Rights is a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize for their work in banning landmines. And Len himself is a veteran of many, many years of struggles for human rights and human dignity. He is an attorney, a wonderful person, which I've known for a while. So I'm very pleased to again have the opportunity to hear Len speak and give his take on these matters.
It's a little unusual. As Stephen said, I'm a lawyer, so I'm not used to appearing on panels with the word psyche in the title. But I have a few things to say. I want to start by just thinking back 7 years ago. 7 years ago was the spring of 2001. And there are very few of us, I think, in this room who could have imagined the destruction and erosion of institutions that we thought were actually indestructible. I'll start with myself as a lawyer. If you had asked me in the spring of 2001 whether in the United States a person could be picked up off the street, put in prison, denied access to a lawyer, denied access to a judge, denied access to being charged with anything, and indefinitely detained, and the president saying, well, we can do that because I've labeled him a terrorist, we would have said, no, that's like communist countries. Those are dictatorships. That's not the United States of America with a constitution. If you had said, imagined back then that our military, which for all its flaws, had spent a quarter of a century training every soldier in the Geneva Conventions, having a legal corps that spent its life interpreting and reinforcing the values of the Geneva Conventions with the military. And if you had thought then that we're going to dispense with the Geneva Conventions, people wouldn't have believed it. And of course, if you thought you were told that doctors and psychologists would be involved in torture, you would have said, not here. All of us would have said that. We have strong institutions, we have strong laws, we have strong values, and yet they were so easily eroded. And it's as hard to understand as it is outrageous. And today we're mostly talking about how the health professions, doctors and psychologists in particular, got involved in these activities. How did this happen? How was it that values, the ultimate values of all the health professions, of doing no harm, being labeled a helping profession, how did people in these professions become so embroiled in these activities that Stephen has described? There's a kind of exceptionalism in the health professions, and I can say this as a lawyer. One thing lawyers don't think is that we're better than everybody else. we know our history. But the idea of medical and psychological exceptionalism is very deeply ingrained. That is, we are not like the rest of the public. We don't have the same rules. That other people are entitled to use coercion against people, but we are not. So how did that all break down? You know, this is kind of illustrated in the aftermath of the bombing in London, the July bombings a couple years ago, with the train bombings where many people were killed. And it turned out that one of the perpetrators was a physician. And within Physicians for Human Rights, and especially on our board, which is composed of some very prestigious people, there was all this anguished emailing back and forth. How is it that a physician who is trained to cure, to treat, to respect human dignity, to use his or her resources to end pain and suffering, how did such a person with such values become involved in terror activities, which we know what terrorism means? It's the deliberate infliction of violence on someone who is completely innocent of anything. How did that happen? Well, that's what I'd like to talk to you about today. I'd like to talk to you about a somewhat different way of talking about medical and psychological exceptionalism, how we got into this mess, and how we got out of this. I've had a chance, through a quirk of my career, to spend about 25 years looking at instances of violations of medical ethics. And so I'd like to share with you some of the experience I've had and how that's affected my own thinking about these problems. And that thinking has led me to a couple of propositions that I'll explore with you today, which could be controversial. One is really controversial, that ethical standards turn out not to be much of a break on behavior when the most is at stake. When the least is at stake, not so bad. But the most is at stake, not much of a break on behavior. And the second proposition is that health professionals act consistently with the culture in which they live, and that exceptionalism is mostly a myth. So here's two stories. Stephen mentioned the MKUltra program. As it happened, as a lawyer 20 years ago, I was involved in an MKUltra case. There was a psychiatrist named Ewan Cameron at McGill University in Montreal, one of the most prestigious psychiatrists in the world. He was president of the American Psychiatric Association. And he was doing some experiments, which we would look back on and describe with only one word, weird. He was trying to change people's thoughts. And he used a process which he called psychic driving, which was to play one-sentence messages for 18 hours at a time or longer, day after day after day, and he called it psychic driving. And he actually tried to enhance psychic driving with other techniques. For example, use of massive barbiturates to induce sleep for many, many days at a time and while the messages are playing. He used the paralytic agent curare. He used massive doses of electroconvulsive therapy. He used LSD. And these were patients who came to him for anxiety, depression, etc. They were psychiatric patients. In those days, in the 50s, it was not uncommon for people of means with those disorders to be hospitalized, so he had them in his hospital. And without their consent, he did these experiments. Well, back in those days, the CIA was interested in Chinese communist brainwashing experiments. How did they find out about Dr. Cameron? Well, it was very easy. He published the results of his work in the Journal of the American Psychiatric Association and many other scientific journals, in which he plainly described what he was doing. And what is most interesting to me about Dr. Cameron is not that the CIA found him out, not even that the CIA funded his work, but that no one raised a peep about what he was doing. His work was subject to peer review. His work was published. His work was known. And yet we could not find a single record of any criticism of Dr. Cameron on ethical grounds in any public way. So we want to think about that. What does that mean? Well, or why? How can we explain that? Well, I think it helps to look at the culture of the time. When we look at the 1950s, we're in the heart of the Cold War. Brainwashing was a really serious issue in the Korean War. There was a desperate attempt to counter it. That it was a time where fear of communism was so great that our laws had been undermined, became illegal, and the Supreme Court upheld it to be a member of certain organizations, and free speech and the First Amendment had really been seriously compromised. Now, these weren't the kind of atrocity-producing situations that Robert Lifton talked about, and not even the kind of closed environment that we hear about what happens to people working in prisons and detention facilities. It was open. It was accepted. But it was really part of a culture. And in that culture, it didn't seem very exceptional or unusual or, to say the least, unethical for someone to be engaged in these kinds of experiments on unwitting patients, such that no one complained. Let me fast forward to a second example. I had the opportunity, in the wake of the end of apartheid in South Africa, to join a delegation that was working with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on a set of hearings they held on the professions. They held hearings on leadership professions in society. They had one on journalism, they had one on law, and they had one on the medical profession. And the behavior of the medical profession in South Africa was appalling. It not only supported apartheid politically, but undermined medical ethics to the core. Now, I should tell you that in South Africa, the white medical society thought of itself very much in the Western tradition. They adopted Western codes of ethics. You may remember the first heart transplant was in South Africa. These were not people who came from a different culture or ethical stance, except that there was a regime that was engaged in institutionalized violence against the black majority population. And so what did doctors get involved in? They got involved in falsifying autopsy reports in prisons. They were all involved in refusing to treat black patients. A friend of mine, two friends, wrote a book called An Ambulance of the Wrong Color, and that referred to the fact that if a black person was injured, for example, in a car accident, a white ambulance would not pick up the person and take him or her to the hospital because it was of the wrong color. So they would rather let people die than breach the apartheid segregation laws. And doctors were a part of this. And, of course, the ultimate was the death of anti-apartheid activist Steve Biko, who was, in his day, the leading activist, who was beaten to death in a jail. But before he was before he died, he was evaluated by two physicians after he'd been severely brain damaged. And the physicians essentially said there's nothing wrong with him, and they put him on the back of a truck and transported him 400 miles, during which trip he died. And the doctors were asked, why did you do this? Why didn't you reveal the extent of his injuries? And they said, well, we subordinated our medical judgment to the security police interests. We can see in this example, probably even more than in the first case, how easy it was for the medical profession to absorb the values of the larger society. And at the Truth and Reconciliation hearings, the reconstituted Medical Society of South Africa came with a kind of mea culpa and basically said, you know, we really abandoned our values because we were part of the regime, we were part of the culture of apartheid in South Africa. Now, it turns out, actually, when you look around the world, these breaches of what we think of fundamental ethical values are actually quite common. I was involved in an international project in which we looked at ways in which ethical breaches took place at the behest of the state. And they're so varied, it's really astonishing. In parts of the world, doctors are involved in so-called virginity exams to determine whether a woman can go to a school. In Turkey, this was the case. You couldn't go to nursing school unless you passed a virginity exam. And putting aside the fact that those are bogus exams, medical community and nurses were involved in doing this exam. All over the world, including in parts of the United States, doctors and nurses don't provide women with reproductive health information because the state doesn't want them to, even though the woman's health would benefit by having that information. We know in this country, as many other countries, people sent to the emergency room are turned over to the police because they need to maintain those relationships, and on and on and on. People subordinate their judgments because they feel they need to do so to advance cultural values. There's one ethicist, actually, by the name of Michael Gross, who has written that for the health professions, citizenship is the only thing that matters. And the idea of exceptionalism, that is, there are things that health professionals can't do, even if others can, is really wrong. And he said, only thing that matters is citizenship. I don't think anybody in this room, including me, would agree with that. So we're not in a new world of complicity when we look at torture by the United States over the last 7 years. But we still have to come to grips with how traditions that were so strong got undermined. We did have, as I mentioned a moment ago, the Geneva Conventions, which the United States had always affirmed. We had laws, criminal laws against torture. We had a War Crimes Act. The CIA had not been involved in interrogation activities for the decade before 9/11. We had, as I said, a military which affirmed the Geneva Conventions. Well, we really need to look at what happened after 9/11. When I started about all the unimaginable things that happened, those are no longer unimaginable. We no longer even think, in some sense, that Guantanamo is all that abnormal. It's a policy problem we have. How did that happen? Well, if you go back to my discussion of the 1950s, I think we have to look at some of the things that happened after 9/11. One, of course, was we had a terrorist attack, which was the most spectacular attack on the United States since Pearl Harbor, and it was at a time when we felt pretty invulnerable as a nation, that this was not going to happen here. And the scope and extent of it, and the fact that we all knew people who died or knew people who knew people who died and saw it on TV, that's pretty traumatic. But more important than that, even, was the exploitation and manipulation of the fear generated by that attack by the President of the United States and his whole administration. That was a decision made at the very beginning, and to me, it is the most significant thing that's happened then and since to change our society. The language of the war on terror, the marginalization of dissent. You may remember when John Ashcroft said, anybody who opposes the Patriot Act is really supporting terrorism. You're really supporting the terrorists if you don't support this law. Dissent was marginalized. The law was immediately undermined. Legal justifications were set out to end the applicability of the Geneva Conventions to the Guantanamo detainees, to undermine the torture law, as you know from all the infamous memos, that reinterpretation of the law, vast expansion of executive power, vast attempt to deny jurisdiction to the courts to oversee executive power. At the same time this was going on, people, all of us, felt a sense of obligation to our country. Military recruitment went up. The war in Afghanistan had 90% popular support. And in that context, I think there's one sentence in the Penn's task force that Stephen mentioned. It's not often quoted because it's not really about the rules, but in a way, it's the most revealing sentence to me about how this change in our culture, which happened overnight and was so deeply exploited by the president and his administration, was reflected. Sentence says, "Psychologists have a valuable and ethical role to assist in protecting our nation, other nations, and innocent nations from harm, which will at times entail gathering information that can be used in our nation's and our nation's defense." Now, I've searched the codes of all the health professions many times, and I've never seen patriotism elevated as a value of the health professionals. When we talk about exceptionalism, this statement is the strongest statement against medical and psychological exceptionalism I have ever read, that we have an obligation to our nation. Well, of course we have an obligation to our nation. We're citizens. But being a citizen and being a professional are somewhat different roles. And sometimes they're inconsistent roles. And that's the whole point of exceptionalism in medical and psychological ethics. But here is a statement saying patriotism is our ethical value and we must act. Well, you are certainly free and perhaps obligated to put your sons and daughters up if there were a draft and have them serve, or if you're young enough to serve yourself. But that's a very different role. That's the citizen role. So we see right away how deeply, deeply this change in our political culture after 9/11 started infecting, and that's the word I think is a proper metaphor, infecting ethics. So what did that result in? Elaborate justifications for participation in national security activities. And it took place in the case of psychology with an association that had already pre-existing and long-standing relationships with the military, including financial relationships in the form of contracts. Now, I'm not going to explain everything the APA did on the basis of financial conflict of interest, but it'd be naive to think that this background is irrelevant. Then we have the problem that has been explored so much. In a culture like this, where dissent is marginalized, where patriotism is Trump's professional exceptionalism, we have the problem of obedience. We have the problem of people doing what they're, quote, supposed to be doing. And that's really, I think, what has been going on. And that's why, in some sense, despite my admiration for the work of Stephen and his colleagues, and even my own involvement in trying to get the American Psychological Association to change its policies, there's a sense in which I think it's the wrong primary target. It's a secondary target. The primary target is the political culture that we're living in and the leadership that is promoting it. I'm not making a partisan speech, I must say. I'm just making a factual statement. Here's how I would put it most simply. The best way to end complicity in torture is to end torture. So, how are we going to do that? We know, every time we think we know all there is to know, we learn something new. We learned just in the last couple of weeks, one thing that Stephen mentioned, that the decisions on torture went up to the highest levels of our government, which is really extraordinary. The president, or maybe not, I don't even know if the president was involved, but the vice president and the secretary of defense and many, many other cabinet officials were involved in torture technique decisions. We learned this week of yet another reinterpretation of the law in which they said, essentially, humiliating, degrading, treatment, violations of human dignity have to be judged by what the purpose is. So if the purpose is to save the United States from a terrorist attack, that's more important than human dignity, which, of course, is not what human rights is about. The protection against torture is absolute, absolute in the Geneva Conventions and all human rights laws. So we learned that this week. So the energy in this room, which I think Stephen stimulated, to me, has to be directed against torture, rendition, forced feeding, denial of habeas corpus, the existence of Guantanamo as a facility. And it's because of the existence of these practices that we have complicity in the first place. So what do we do? And what about professional values? I mean, I don't want anybody to think that professional values are unimportant or that more, that they're meaningless. I would never think such a thing or say such a thing. It's right to demand compliance with professional values. It's right to affirm the exceptionalism of do no harm. It's right to insist that professional associations adopt those norms. But we have to get to the reason why they're violated, that socialization into the values of the profession has to be reinforced in a way that can counter the cultural values that are undermining it. And in fact, this meeting is a product of that effort. It's also right to make demands of the American Psychological Association because they play a key role in support to individuals. So I'd like to suggest three things to do. The first is, as I said, we need to stop torture, and we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity, perhaps not in the next 9 months, but in the succeeding administration, whoever becomes president. That president, though, is going to be under severe pressure. I don't care if it's Obama, Clinton, or McCain. Any one of them is going to be under severe pressure not to do too much, to try to kind of cut the baby in half, to end the worst forms of torture, but not to necessarily to end extraordinary renditions or secret detention. It's not going to be easy to close Guantanamo either because nobody in the United States wants these people. There was a resolution in the Senate that passed 99-0 saying do not send these people to Leavenworth in Kansas. Well, that was at the behest of the Kansas congressional delegation. But you can be sure that whether it's Arizona, Massachusetts, Washington State, Texas, or Florida will get a similar resolution. So it's going to be very important for people to stay involved, in restoring the law, into ending the practices at every level. The second is to focus on prevention. The way to focus on prevention from a professional standpoint is to end the possibility of being in a circumstance where all the forces that we know exist, the ones I talked about today, plus the other forces which people like Phil Zimbardo and Robert Lifton talk about what it's like to be in a closed environment. We have to prevent people from being in those situations. We can't insist that people be heroes. That never works, especially in the health professions. Whistleblowing is not much of a tradition. And I don't mean that in a catty way. It's just very, very hard. So we have to have really tough rules saying you shouldn't get involved in interrogation in the first place. You shouldn't get involved in situations where the possibility of being compromised and your ethical values being subverted can take place. And that's why a bright line is so important. It's a line the medical community has adopted, but so far the American Psychological Association has not. If we're really serious about complicity, we have to take people out of situations where we know they're going to get compromised. And the third step is support for people. It's such a truism that we know that people, whether it's a teenager who we don't want to get pregnant or someone working in a military facility, in order to achieve the outcomes that we all think are important, those people need support. You can't say, here's the rule, obey the rule. You in this room, who know a lot more about psyche than I do, know that deeply, that people can't do things without support. And the professional associations have been almost completely absent. And I'm talking about every professional association, the AMA, other medical associations, the American Psychological Association, in providing support to people who are going to be in situations that are fraught with danger to ethical values. We need to have institutional mechanisms of support so people can avoid engagement, even a simple thing like a hotline. If you got a problem, call this hotline, and we will have people support you. Not kind of the ethics, you know, we have an ethical question, something really serious in terms of support. And there are other institutional mechanisms. So those three things, we have to fight this on the political level, we have to avoid opportunity for complicity, and we have to provide institutional mechanisms. Then, at the next conference, when we have a similar situation, which we know we'll have again in our lifetimes or in the next people's lifetimes, we can say with some pride, the values of the health professions triumphed, and they didn't become involved and besmirch their own reputations and those of their colleagues. Thank you.
Leonard Rubinstein, President of Physicians for Human Rights.
The final speaker is Eric Fair. I had read his op-ed piece in the Washington Post. It's a very compelling piece entitled An Iraqi Interrogator's Nightmare. Eric's currently a divinity student at Princeton University. He's one of apparently only two former interrogators who have gone public to describe the situation. Eric?
I am a first-year student at the Princeton Theological Seminary, and Princeton takes pride in speaking. They like to send people away, and they have what's called Princeton Speak. You become a pastor or a minister, and preaching is very important. So all first-year students are required to take a very rigorous speaking class. We spend a year erasing bad habits and learning how to not be nervous and those sorts of things. I can tell you this morning that all of those will go out the window. This is a very unpleasant topic for me, something I do not like to speak about. Every day I wish that I could find a way to just be quiet and go away. So I apologize, but I will read you from a manuscript this morning. It allows me to keep my thoughts collected and to keep them brief. My story of Abu Ghraib, my involvement in coerced interrogation, and the issues surrounding the consequences of those actions since my return are, in a word, complicated. I assure you that if you come to this issue knowing exactly what it is that you think, with firm convictions, whether in support of my position or opposed, you have not grasped the complexity of this issue. I've been on both sides of this issue, both as a well-intentioned supporter of abusive tactics, as well as an unbending opponent to all forms of coercion. As for the war in Iraq, I currently stand opposed to the conflict, but I am not so foolish as to believe that I have all the answers. I, in fact, believe a rational debate can be had about the efficacy of the invasion, as well as our current mission there. The mission in Iraq may still have value. It may still be one that we can win. I tend to disagree with those positions, but at the very least, I can respect the logic and the good intentions that drive them. What I cannot respect and what I refuse to tolerate is a position that suggests the intensity of this current conflict, or any conflict for that matter, serves to justify the erosion of the very values for which so many of us have fought. Arguments about the protection of innocent lives and ticking time bombs are powerful, to be sure. And in 2004, I was one who was making them. But experience has taught me a very painful lesson about the devastating consequences of coercive interrogation. In the spring of 2004, while serving on a small interrogation team in Fallujah, I was asked to participate in the sleep deprivation of an Iraqi detainee. Sleep deprivation was common in Iraq in 2004. It was used by interrogators across the theater. Now, I'm the father of a six-month-old son, and many have joked that I now have experienced sleep deprivation myself. Many of you in the room here this morning are from academic fields, I suspect from very rigorous academic programs. You, too, have undoubtedly experienced more than your share of sleepless nights. Rest assured, however, that a simple lack of sleep, no matter how long it may last, no matter how exhausting it may feel, has nothing in common with the tactic known as sleep deprivation. Sleep deprivation involves taking a prisoner of war and stripping away what little sense of hope he or she may have left. The prisoner has no way of knowing when or if he will ever sleep again. Life suddenly has no future. A day never ends, which is to say that there is never a tomorrow. One does not go to sleep. One does not wake up. Time essentially stands still. And a man who can see no future is stripped of hope. This can be done in 2 or 3 hours, not 2 or 3 weeks or 2 or 3 months. It's immediate. Once a man is stripped of hope, his mind can torture him more than any stress position, any police working dog, or any enhanced tactic ever can. Now, the first time I entered this detainee's room and roused him from his sleep, I recognized that I had crossed a line. As instructed, I stripped him of his clothes and forced him to stand in the cold, which only increased his sense of despair. And though I had witnessed others employ this technique at places like Abu Ghraib, I had never done it myself, and the experience shook me to the core. I was overtaken not only by a sense of moral outrage, but by an intoxicating feeling of power. I controlled this man's entire life, his body, his emotions, his mind, and his spirit. His entire life rested in my hands, and I could manipulate it however I saw fit. Now, in the midst of a violent and unforgiving insurgency raging around us, and considering comrades of mine may very well have been wounded or killed by the man now standing before me, I would be lying if I said I was not tempted in some way to proceed. In such moments when we are forced to choose what we may feel an unnatural path, we search for justification, and if we can find none, we move on to excuses. And as a man who sees things in black and white, I could find none. The experience shattered my convictions. I hadn't just thought about crossing that line. I had stepped right over it. I hung on a few weeks longer, desperate to salvage something out of the experience of Iraq, but eventually quit my job and returned home in the hopes of forgetting about what I had done. It did not work. I was plagued by nightmares, anger, and depression. I self-medicated with seclusion and alcohol. Now, as the debate moves forward about abusive interrogation, we hear impassioned arguments from an administration that insists it has an obligation to reserve aggressive techniques for the most frightening of scenarios. But it is this very lack of courageous leadership that leaves open a door that should have been closed long ago. We claim a moral high ground based only on convenience. Discipline is an army's greatest attribute, and for those that have served, like me, we know that all too well. Soldiers with clear directives based on firm and uncompromising chain of command will wield violence in a controlled manner in order to accomplish the most heroic of tasks. But take those same soldiers, deprive them of clear directives, remove discipline, and then toss them into the complex world of human conflict, to say nothing of the chaos of Abu Ghraib, and they will wield that same violence in the most irresponsible of ways, to the shame of the very cause they swore to defend. The shame, however, is not entirely theirs. It falls on the shoulders of those who swore to lead them, those who swore to give them clear direction, and those who swore to never let them stray. The soldier does not fail, the leader fails. Anyone who has worn stripes on his shoulder or stars and bars on his collar knows this all too well. And in the United States, the chain of command does not end at the feet of a uniformed general, nor does it end at the feet of the President of the United States. It ends squarely at the feet of the American people. And so the debate about interrogation is not to be had in the interrogation booths of Iraq or on the prison grounds of Guantanamo Bay or in the Oval Office of the White House. It is to be held here at home by the people responsible for the well-being of our servicemen and women. We must not send them into the chaos of war armed with ambiguity. And as long as we tell them that there are exceptions to every rule or circumstances that call for enhanced techniques or ticking time bomb scenarios or a need to operate in the dark side, rest assured, abuse will continue and the values of this nation will continue to erode. The door to abusive interrogation remains wide open. And as long as we tell one another that it is a necessary evil or a regrettable necessity, we as a nation will continue to fall short of the incredible high standards that we have all been called. As I sit here in this church this morning, and as I myself as a seminary student, I can offer no solutions. All I can say is that may God help us bring this horrific chapter in American history to an abrupt end. Thank you.
Eric Fair, former interrogator in Iraq. Those talks from a forum, Torture and the American Psyche, recorded by Dory Smith of TalkNationRadio.org. Thanks for listening to another edition of Unwelcome Guests on the web at unwelcomeguests.org Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.